was around 1957. And by 1958, we were hot and heavy into that project. And although I was a relatively young engineer, I was essentially the systems architect of the project. Put together a lot of the ideas that we used for acquisition, for deacquisition, for various mechanisms for generating the pseudorandom sequences and phase lock loops and all the other things that are very much part of a modern digital system, except they were all built with discrete components, initially with miniature vacuum tubes. But by the time 1958 came around, they were transistorized. Mm-hmm. Still individual discrete components. I worked on that, but also at the same time I worked on other things which eventually became part of my current interests and involvement, and that is satellite communications. Mm-hmm. 1957, when I joined them, was, I think, the year of the Sputnik. And there was a lot of interest and a lot of stimulation of the notion that you could use satellites for communications, surveillance, and various other things, which are, of course, the mainstay of modern communication satellites. Indeed, at the time, the concept of a geosynchronous orbit satellite, while it was known, was out of reach because the booster rockets weren't big enough. Mm-hmm. So, some of the things I did had to do with low Earth orbit satellites. We call them today LEOs, but we didn't use that name at the time. Including the question of coverage, how many satellites you need to get coverage in what areas of the Earth, and so on. So a lot of the calculations involved astrodynamics and things that were not directly related to communications, but since it was a communications problem, one had to know what the visibility is and how often you have to hand off the satellites in order to use it. So those were the two principal things that I worked on at ITT, satellite communication and spread spectrum. But predominantly, far and away, it was spread spectrum. At the time, spread spectrum had two principal functions. One was to minimize the effects of jamming, of intentional jamming on the part of an adversary. And I'm sure I don't have to go into the details of why there's a benefit to that. That by now all declassified and totally well written about. And the other had to do with low probability of intercept, which is really the other side of the coin. Instead of worrying about a large jammer disrupting your communication, we were concerned with using spread spectrum in a sense that would hide your communications below the noise level so that it would be difficult to intercept or detect that you're actually transmitting. It was very valuable to deny an enemy the ability to even perceive your presence. And to a large extent, that stayed classified. And for all I know, a lot of it may still be classified because it's a very sensitive subject, but there's also a lot of it now written across the literature as well. Mm-hmm. By about the period of about 1961, I decided to go back to graduate school. I took a leave of absence from ITT, which I believe I never rescinded. So it might still be on somebody's books, but I don't think it's anything meaningful. And I went back to graduate school at the Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn. After an interview and a discussion with my subsequent thesis advisor by the name of Misha Schwartz,